Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Caribbean Studies. I'm your host, Alejandra Bronfman, and I'm really excited to be sharing this interview today with Manuel Barcia, who's the author of a book called The Yellow Demon of Fever, Fighting Disease in the 19th Century Transatlantic Slave Trade, just out with Yale University Press. The book explores issues we've all confronted recently: disease, how it spreads, how to stop the spread, and the unexpected consequences of widespread sickness. Barcia asked these questions in the specific context of the aftermath of the abolition of the slave trade. While illegal slave trade was still practiced and, in fact, transporting thousands of enslaved Africans across the oceans, this book is fascinating in its own right, but now it's more resonant than ever. So here's our conversation. Hi, Manuel. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Sandra.
It's such a pleasure to get to talk to you about your book today. So let's start with a kind of origin story. And I know that you've been writing about slavery and rebellion and the slave trade for quite a long time now, but maybe you can tell us a little bit about how you got the idea for this particular book.
Right. Okay. Thank you again for having me. The idea for this book actually was always there, I think. From the moment I started going to archives and working with primary sources, it was quite apparent that there was a story to tell about disease. And this is something you would probably remember because we have kind of a common history together. We had a colleague back in the 90s, Adrian Lopez, who used to work on disease. He was working on for his dissertation on the cholera epidemic of 1833 in Havana. So this was always there. It was always in the conversations. And as the years went by, and I went from being a historian of Cuban slavery to a historian of Atlantic slavery and slave trade, I found more and more references to disease and the fight against disease, not only in the Hispanic Atlantic, but also in the British Atlantic, in the French Atlantic. Wherever I looked, there were documents. And there were references, and many of them were quite interesting, actually. So I started taking notes. All these years I have been taking notes, and at some point it became kind of I came to a fork in the road, and then I had to decide whether to do something with that, to start reading more about American history, and try to make sense of all the material I have been gathering over the years. Or just to keep using them, you know, as I think I mentioned that in the book, as snippets to pepper the other stuff I was doing. But the information was so rich and it was so much as well that I decided to give it a go. And for a long time, it was really touch and go. I had many doubts about this book over the years, but eventually it happened, actually, and I'm glad that it happened because it allowed me to see a number of things that I had never seen before, like, for instance, to look at the slave trade and to look at the Atlantic from a completely different perspective, what David Armitage refers to as a circumatlantic scope. And it also allowed me to, for the first time, actually, to look at how the history of a slavery and the slave trade, they link in a more concrete way with the history of other parts of the world as well, and how we cannot understand Atlantic history if we don't look beyond the Atlantic. So I think that all these things, like, they came into play at some point.
They do. And you can, and I want to talk about some of those a little bit later, and you can really see all of the kind of connections that you're trying to build. And it is true, in the interest of full disclosure, we met when I was just starting out as a historian of Cuba, and you were already one of the, you and Adrián were the people who knew the most about that archive of anybody probably in Havana at the time. So we do go back a long way.
Many moons ago.
Yeah. But it's interesting, actually, that, and I do remember all of those conversations about disease that we engaged in. And I thought about this book, and, you know, when people read this book years from now, they are going to see that it was published the same year as the COVID-19 pandemic. But of course, you had the idea years ago, and in particular, you probably started writing this without any idea that this is what, you know, the context would be when we were talking about it. Yep. So was there something else that you were responding to at that moment that said to you, you know, okay, I need to write this book now?
Well, you know, the struggle against disease is something, especially epidemic diseases, but I have to disclose as well that this is not a book about epidemic diseases only. This is a book about human experience as well, dealing with challenges and how people can interact with each other and cooperate. And but I really think that the struggle against disease is an ongoing thing. Since the turn of the century, we had SARS, we had MERS, we had the swine flu. So we have had warnings. You know, this COVID-19 virus is not something that we should really be surprised with. I mean, I think that it has been more than what we would have expected, but epidemics have been happening all over the world throughout the last 20 years. There were Ebola epidemics more than once. There have been cholera epidemics in many different places, in Haiti, Angola. The epidemics are there. Of course, I didn't predict it. That I was going to be publishing this book in the middle of the largest epidemic of our lifetimes. And of course, the interesting thing with this is how I have come to leave myself some of the same things that I read about, which is I think in that sense, I have been sort of privilege. I'm not sure if the word is a correct word for what I'm trying to express, but to have the opportunity I'm going to focus, for instance, on the anxieties and the fears that I have felt since all this started, and I can relate them to stuff that I have read before. I can relate to the same anxieties and fears that people all over the Atlantic had whenever one of these epidemic. A stroke. For instance, in 1823, there is a yellow fever epidemic all over the Atlantic world. There is another one in 1829-30. And you can read what people are saying. You can read about the deep fears that they have about this. And also, and this is quite relevant for what is happening right now, something that comes up from the sources very clearly is how people came together to fight these diseases, right? How they were able to share knowledge, information, et cetera, which is something that is not happening at the rate we would expect it to happen, I think. We have quite a lot of things, I think, to learn from the 19th century Atlantic right now in the fight against COVID. But, you know, this is... it's a long story, really.
Yeah, I mean, there really are so many resonances with. As I was reading it, I thought, oh my God, quarantine, you know, and 2 weeks, and there's so many ways in which people reacted, in such similar ways. But there are actually also, obviously, huge differences, right? And one of the things that's so interesting about this book is the moment in the history of the slave trade that you set it in, and it's a moment that's not very well studied, which is post-abolition of the slave trade, but still with slavery going on. So there's this kind of very, very complicated illegal slave trade going on and these efforts to stop it. And so I wonder if you can just set the stage for people who are less familiar with that period.
Oh, yes, by all means. Well, basically, as most people know, in 1807, the British are going to abolish the slave trade, and they are going to start enforcing these abolition policies across the Atlantic. This is obviously going to have consequences. They are going to have plenty of consequences. One of them is that they start forcing abolition treaties on other nations. Sometimes they do so via the diplomatic means. Sometimes they do so by using their guns. But they enforce abolition throughout the Atlantic. They are also going to create commission courts, mixed commission courts, and vice admiralty courts that they are going to basically take care of processing all the slave trade ships they capture, and the crews as well. An occasion, and they are going to liberate, and I'm using inverted commas here, the Africans they take on board. But as you say, at the same time, slavery still continues. In the case of Cuba and Brazil until the 1880s, in the case of the United States until the 1860s. The truth is that most of the slave trade that happens in the post-1807 world is directed towards two main regions in the Americas, Cuba and Brazil, which are the two places that continue to import large number of slaves. After 1820, there are Africans landing in the United States and in other parts of the Americas, but the two main places are these two, and of course these two places also happen to be the last two places that abolished slavery, so there is a correlation there as well. The slave trade in this period, because of its illicit character, has eluded most of the historians of medicine who had taken on the slave trade and slavery before. So, for instance, when we look at the work of other historians who have studied a medical side of history in the slave trade, most of them they have looked at the pre-1807 period, overwhelmingly so. There are some exceptions, but most of them they have looked at the story before 1807, and of course. This is to a certain extent or to a large extent related as well with the fact that the story in the post-1807 war is a story that is mostly concealed. This is an illicit business and as such, it doesn't generate as many documents as the illicit business before would do. And the other challenge that you have here is that the slave traders are themselves a very international crew. So they are doing their business in a concealed manner, and they are doing their business in languages other than English as well. Because we always in the English speaking academy, we tend to look first at the British or the Americans. But in this case, you have plenty of documents in French, in Spanish, in Portuguese, in Arabic, German. So and they are spread all over the Atlantic, and this is another challenge here. So it is a period that is really challenging to study, right? Now, if I were looking at the history of slavery and not slave trade, slavery, it could be easier in the sense that slavery is going to be legal. So slavery is legal in the United States until the 1860s, in Cuba and Brazil until the 1880s, in France and other parts until the 1840s. So the documents produced in these slave societies are plentiful, unlike the documents pertaining to a slave trade. So even though they are chronologically parallel, the documents for the slave trade are significantly the number of documents is significantly smaller than the number of documents that you will find if you decide to study any aspect of the history of medicine, say in the British Caribbean or in Brazil or in the United States.
So it's a real challenge to get at the stories here, and you can see that in the very careful way that you look at the sources. But there's an argument also that you're making, which is that actually the abolition of the slave trade is worse for the health of people who were enslaved, in fact, right? Because there was this kind of there are some regulations that were in place before, and the elimination of the slave trade means the elimination of some of those regulations. And so the illicit trade means also that the health of enslaved people suffered.
Yeah, I would actually even take it further right now than when I wrote the book. I think that it's obvious that beyond the regulations that they become irrelevant after 1807, there is also the fact that the British are policing the Atlantic. And soon after, other nations are going to start policing the Atlantic to different extents. They don't commit as much as the British, most of them anyway. But the Americans, they have squadrons to suppress the slave trade. The French, they have a very effective squadron in the 1840s to suppress the French slave trade. The Portuguese, and even the Brazilians, they have squadrons for suppressing the slave trade. So what this means for the slave traders is that they have to go on the ground even more, which in this case, in many parts of West Africa, means going inland. So whereas before they would have the factories the factories by the coast, as close to the coast as possible, now they go inland, they go into the rivers, into the lagoon that runs parallel to the West African coast from what is today Benin and Nigeria and Togo. They need to hide their activities, right? And this, of course, means that we know even less about what is happening there. But for the Africans who are going to be traded, who are going to be trafficked into the transatlantic slave trade, now the processes of enslavement and trafficking are going to be even more, they're going to be faster, and they are going to be less regulated as well. Well, before, because the slave traders were not being policed, they would take their time to examine the health of their human cargoes. And that would, of course, have consequences for the transatlantic slave trade, for the Middle Passage. If you manage to check the health of a group of human beings you're going to put on the belly of a ship, and you make sure that they are all healthy, it's less likely that you're going to have an epidemic on board. And after 1807, especially after 1820, this is going to be less and less the case. They are going to hurry the shipments, and this is going to lead to even more disease in the Middle Passage. And we can see this from the sources. But you can also actually see this from the statements of people who are engaged in abolishing the slave trade. Until very late, until the 1860s, you can see how French, British, they are repeatedly saying the same thing. The slave traders are becoming more cunning. They have to do their activities in hiding. But because of the pressure we are putting, for instance, we have entire human groups who have spent months in barracoons along the African coast who cannot be shipped to Americas, and they are dying in these barracoons in horrible conditions. So whereas the intention was overall a positive intention, it definitely had unintended consequences that were negative for the people they were trying to help.
Right. And you also get this strange kind of coming together of the traders and the people who are enforcing the abolition, who are sort of coming together in the interest of enslaved people's health, even though, you know, it's deteriorating so rapidly. And there's a kind of agreement that yeah, something needs to be done, even though these people are supposedly on opposing sides, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is quite an interesting point because it relates directly with what is happening today. These people, they were all fighting disease. Okay, disease does not discriminate. I mean, you can argue that if you are wealthy and you have a better medical attention, you may do better, but it might kill you all the same. And this disease did not discriminate. So slave traders, Africans in general, who were involved in the slave trade in one way or another, either as enslaved or as slavers, and people who were tasked with implementing abolition policies in the Atlantic, they are all having to face a common enemy. And they are obviously very keen on doing everything they can to stop these diseases from spreading, because when these diseases spread, any of them may fall to them. And this there is a direct correlation to what is happening today with this, because we are not seeing as much of that as we should today. We are seeing in some countries a lot of blame games being played, somebody blaming somebody else for not doing this or for doing that. We are seeing how, in many cases, financial gains, in this case the economy, are being put before human populations. So this is really relevant in the sense that we could, I think I made this point before, I think we could learn so much more from what people who hated each other were able to do together back then to share information, to disseminate information, to help each other in any way they could. Things that are not happening really today in the way they should, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I guess the other thing, one other thing about this book that you mentioned a little bit earlier, but that I want to talk more about is the geographic scope, right? And that also kind of resonates. We have now this visualization, I guess, of all of the data all over the world all the time, right? But the story that you tell ranges so broadly from the African continent to the Americas and takes place in the ocean. Why was it important to have such a broad geographic scope?
Well, basically because diseases and epidemics, they are not willing to respect borders. There are no borders for epidemics. That's why, to a certain extent, quarantines sometimes may work and sometimes they may not work. You cannot isolate yourself forever. Right? And I think that 19th century actors understood this to a certain extent, even though quarantines were used and abused. I do think that the very fact that diseases are transnational entities that do not respect borders is central to this story. And that's why it's an Atlantic story. I thought long and hard to where I should focus on what I knew best, which is the Spanish Atlantic or the Portuguese Atlantic, but it didn't really make any sense because I was looking at the history that had tentacles everywhere, all over the place. Many of the human stories that I'm telling in this book start in Africa and then you can pick them up in the Americas, or they stay in the Atlantic in one way or another. And that goes for the slave ships, that goes for the slave traders, go for Africans. It goes for everybody who is involved in this story. So I really think that this is a something that is central to disease, is that it's not to a study of disease, is that they are not going to conform to any sort of national or state nation state methodologies, because they really don't work in this case. Although of course you can pick that story and focus on a country, but you're missing the big picture. You cannot really study countries in a bubble.
Right, and what you do with such a broad geographic scope, which might kind of seem unwieldy in terms of telling a story, and you do actually tell a story here. It's not just a kind of list of a bunch of things, is that you use these things that you call contact zones, right? So you have the ship, the idea of the ship as a contact zone, and then some of the factories, some of the barracones. How did you come to that kind of formulation?
Well, contact zone is a concept that was, it's not my concept, it's Mary Louise Pratt's concept. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was very useful for what I was doing. Actually, I tried to reframe it and to kind of create something new, which I call slave trade contact zones. I don't think it's a groundbreaking idea, but it was really helpful as a methodological tool for me. And it allowed me to see where these exchanges of diseases take place. But not only exchanges of diseases, this exchange of merchandise, exchange of body fluids, exchange of ideas, everything happens in these contact zones, right? It is there where people come together and where the transmission of diseases take place. But it is also there where prophylactic measures are taken. It is also there where diagnosis, prognosis, and treatments take place. So they really allow me to frame my study in a way that was sensible. And I think that without having the contact zones as a place, as a space, it would have been very difficult to study disease from an Atlantic perspective, because I wouldn't have known where to locate the discussions. So the same way the slave ship, as you mentioned, is a contact zone, there are many other contact zones. Slave barracoons are contact zones. A number of towns and villages are also contact zones, and even you can trace out to plantations on the Americas, on the American side. So it becomes quite useful, actually.
The other side of that is something that you mentioned just a minute ago, which is the quarantine, right? And there's really interesting material about the politics of quarantine.
Yeah.
That seems like such a neutral response, right? But there's actually a politics to it, and you show that. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Oh yeah, I think that quarantines, in many ways, they can be useful or not, and this is something you can see also in this book. On occasion, and depending on the disease you're trying to contain, they may work. In many ways, the problem with the diseases that I'm discussing in this book is that the historical actors that are at the center of this book did not know how these diseases were transmitted. So it was very much a guessing work. So that's why quarantines not always work. For instance, there were huge discussions about contagionism, or how infectious a disease could be and how contagious it could be in a specific environment. And these discussions usually went around quite a while and focused mostly on two diseases, yellow fever and the bubonic plague. And quarantines were used to demonstrate that they were highly contagious or that they were not. But in reality, the thing is that they could not tell that one of these diseases was transmitted by a mosquito, that was the vector carrier, and the other was transmitted by fleas. So you can isolate populations, but still the fleas may make their way there, or the mosquitoes make their way there. So they could not really tell. And I think that this is a really significant point here, is for quarantines to actually work, you need to know, to have a deep understanding of the disease you're trying to contain. Now, quarantines, as you say, as well, they serve political agendas. And they are very convenient forms of social control, and more importantly, even of redefining social control. They give opportunities to people who are in power to bring up measures that they state, that they are supposed to be extraordinary measures in a specific moment in time because of an epidemic, but then they may stay. And people are scared of these things, right? That's why you get so many people complaining about quarantines, because they are scared that they are always going to stay home. Not so much because of the economy, but they are afraid of their own governments in many ways. And you can see this happening today, but you can also trace it back to even, you know, ancient Greece. The way in which quarantines are used to redefine societies. And in many ways, there is an Australian historian, Alison Bashford. She discussed quarantines as ways of containment, and she actually has a pretty interesting concept, which is the dream of hygienic containment concept, which is basically that to a certain extent they are just a bluff. They just allow for the implementation of extreme measures and to give the impression that those in power are doing something that is effective. They may calm down people as well. They may give the feeling of security. Things are better. We are taking measures, but in reality, these measures may or may not be effective at all. This is a thing. The main thing about quarantine is that also in the case of West Africa and West Central Africa in the 19th century, whenever quarantines were established, they allowed for the implementation of new measures that later on favor European agendas, like, for instance, trade agendas or colonialist agendas as well.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how all of this plays out, and fascinating to see what an impact all of those things had on the outcomes of the slave trade and its abolition. And I want to talk a little bit about the methods for thinking about healing, right? Because you talk about healers and remedies coming from Europe, coming from Africa, generated in the Americas. You draw from the work of Pablo Gomez and other people. Yeah. And it seems to have been a real a very deliberate and careful reading of the sources, right, to better understand how healing operated and how it was practiced. So I would love to hear you sort of talk about how you did that.
Well, for a start, the problem with the sources is that the sources were written in the vast majority or produced in the vast majority by Europeans or Westerners, to be more precise. So they are overwhelmingly represented in those sources as well. Their methods, their ideas, their ways of understanding disease and of treating disease as well, they are overwhelmingly represented. Also, in most of the works in which they actually discuss how others, and in this by others I mean Africans and in some cases actually indigenous populations in the Americas, they understood disease and they treated disease, they tend to be quite contemptuous. They try to undermine any knowledge that is not Western knowledge. There are exceptions to this rule, but this happens quite a lot. So to try to avoid falling in the trap of discussing or talking about Western practitioners, health practitioners, risking their lives, going into contact zones, and which were nothing to use a recent debate. There was a recent debate about this when Oxfam workers were accused of certain things in Haiti, going to disaster zones and stuff like that. It was really important to try to read between the lines that there were some cases in which Western practitioners or Western travelers would give credit to the Africans for the knowledge, but most of the time they just undermined that knowledge. So they considered them and they called them names, they called them quacks, they called them witch doctors, etc., etc. But even in those cases, quite often they were forced to describe what the African practitioners did, where the knowledge came from. They were forced to describe the effectiveness of their pharmacopoeia as well. And as I said, even though they were trying to undermine this knowledge, they were trying to present themselves as superior to the Africans, still they had no option but to highlight the effectiveness of their methods and their knowledge. And as I said, from the beginning, I set out to avoid giving this idea of the Western practitioner or the Western traveler or the Western officer going into a dangerous place, risking his life to save the poor Africans. I really, really wanted to say clear from that, because this, unfortunately, this has happened very often, and I see we get this discourse. I wanted to bring the Africans into the picture. I wanted to show that African knowledge was very often comparable or more advanced than Western knowledge when it comes to treating the diseases of the slave trade. And that had to be recognized by Western practitioners. They had no option but to recognize this and to incorporate it into their fragmentary medical knowledge at the time. Let's make something clear here. The Europeans, the Westerners, they did not know how yellow fever was transmitted. They did not even have yet a clear name for something like malaria, even though some people were calling it like that. Fevers were fevers. Okay, there were different kinds of fevers. There were the Corn River, intermittent fever, etc., etc., but they had not settled. And it would be a long time before they would find out how these diseases were transmitted. So they were, for instance, being able to use quinine at the time, which was something they were doing ahead of the Africans. But even then, they were not using it in an effective way. It would take a few years into the 1850s, 1860s, until the Europeans and the Westerners started using quinine in an effective way. And this is when they are allowed finally to enter Africa and to start colonizing Africa. So I really think that it is important. It was really important for me to bring African practitioners into the equation and to show how they contribute to the medical knowledge at the time, how they contribute to changing medical cultures in the Atlantic at the time, that they were not just simple witnesses, passive witnesses, or that they were, witch doctors or quacks or whatever they were called. No, they were actual health practitioners who had knowledge that had been probably amassed over centuries that was quite useful for the Europeans. Actually, it even allowed them to carry out their slave trading or anti-slave trading work in Africa to a certain extent.
Another irony, of course.
Yeah,
right?
Of course. Yeah.
One other thing about the sources that I noticed that I really enjoyed was the use of images. And you talk mm-hmm. about paintings and drawings not as kind of illustrations of what happens, but sometimes as actually arguments against what we think we know mm-hmm. about
yeah.
The slave trade.
Yeah, I really think that as a 19th century historian, having worked most of the time to a period that ends in the 1860s, 1870s, one thing that I always found challenging was, and I felt jealous of colleagues who are working in other periods, more recent periods, is that the imagery that I have, the iconography that I have, or have had, has been quite limited. But this book actually gave me a chance of looking at new stuff that have been published or have been coming to light in recent times. The National Maritime Museum in London has amazing collections where you can see this depictions of different aspects of the slave trade. And they really highlight parts of this slave trade that I didn't even know about. And there are other images as well. For instance, there is I still have this watercolor. It was brought to my attention by a colleague, Richard Anderson, of a group of sailors from the ship Bonetta. It's a British ship engaged in the abolition of the slave trade in the Atlantic in 1837, basically having a great time in Freetown, in Sierra Leone, between the missions. And they are basically smoking, drinking, hanging out with prostitutes, African prostitutes. And this in itself is already quite interesting. But if you trace the story of these men, who are, by the way, identified in the watercolor, the names are there, you will find out that 2 weeks later, most of them were dead. Most of them had died of yellow fever in the yellow fever epidemic of that year, 1837. So you can see the same names, and they had died 2 weeks later. And more interesting, I also found another watercolor, which is also in the book, of the cemetery in the Bonetta Cemetery in Ascension Island. And the cemetery is named after the ship, so that you have an idea of how bad the epidemic was in the ship. And some of them are buried there. So you can actually trace the story of this men for over 2 weeks, from the moment they were drinking, smoking, having sex, to 2 weeks later, they died, and a little bit later, they are buried in this other place for which we also have an image. And in other cases, like for instance, the painting that is a cover of a book, you can actually see, you can compare what your eyes can see, or the eyes of the painter of this slave ship saw, with what the British who were in Havana reported about this ship, the Negrito, in 1832, 1833. And you can see that the report of the British, compared to what you're seeing in the picture, is quite mild, it's quite positive. This is not a ship that did particularly bad when it comes to disease. And yet, if you look at the image, it is quite distressing. The situation on board of the ship, and we are only seeing the deck of the ship, is quite distressing. There are quite a lot of men and women laying on the floor, and you can tell that they are in distress. So if a ship that was supposed, or according to the British, was supposed to have done relatively well disease-wise during the Middle Passage, looks so badly in a painting, you can imagine the ones that they actually did not do well in the Middle Passage. What kind of situation would have been on board the ships? So, of course, it allows you to make arguments and to speculate as to how well how were the descriptions, or how were the descriptions of the sufferings of these men and women were coming from people who saw them from afar.
Yeah, it's a really good reason to suggest that people buy the book and take a very careful look at the images, just like you did. So just to wrap up, I've taken up lots of your time, but I'm wondering, kind of the obvious question, how has your thinking about this book changed over the last 3 or 4 months? And do you wish you had done something different, or are you going to move on to the next project in order to do that different thing?
Probably I would have put epidemic in the title. seriously. I really think that it, as I said at the beginning of the interview, it has given me kind of a personal, a very, very unique view of the time we're living in. I really think that it has given me a perspective after reading all these things, many of the things that are not even in the book, as you can imagine. There are hundreds of documents that didn't make it into a book, about how governments are responding to this epidemic, to what extent they are prioritizing the economy over human lives. I've just seen that Donald Trump has said that the price to pay for economic recovery is the price of human lives. And so far, no journalist has asked yet how many exactly, how many human lives are you going to sacrifice to this endeavor to bring the country back on? Because it's kind of difficult. In the book, I actually have a citation from Laura Murphy. She basically says that the practice of sacrificing human life for the sake of material gain is a legacy of the devastating devaluation of human life that was integral to the workings of the slave trade. I don't see that much difference. I can see more and more similarities between slave traders, the way they function, and some of the measures that are being taken by some governments in the world today. It's not that different. So in many ways, writing this book, researching for this book, has given me very, very strong opinions about the things that are happening around me as well. And as you mentioned before as well, even the good guys, and again, I'm using inverted commas here, very often when they take a position, they take a measure, they do so without calculating the unexpected consequences of their actions. So that's also something we need to keep in mind in all this. As for my research, how it has informed my research, well, I can tell you I'm not writing about this anymore. I have promised myself to write this book and then move on, and this is what I have done. I'm writing about pirates now, but I'm working on a global history of the suppression of piracy in the 19th century. But the one thing that I really, really think that is worth highlighting from this book is how people in front of a crisis, before a crisis, that threaten the life, are capable of coming together and fighting that crisis together. And as I said before, they did it in the 19th century, even though they were actually enemies. They were able to come together to share this knowledge, to do everything they could to stop epidemics from spreading. And I would hope that people today would be able to do the same thing, especially governments. But unfortunately, I'm not sure this is happening right now.
Well, thank you so much. You've given us so much to think about and to look forward to in your next book. I really, really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you so much, Annie.